Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Hi there, everyone. Today, I've got Ron Hertel. He is the program supervisor for Compassionate Schools at Washington State's Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction. The Compassionate Schools Initiative is a program that provides resources to schools that want to consider a trauma-responsive infrastructure. They support students and are ultimately focused on helping Washington teachers understand the fundamentals of brain development and function, recognizing self-care maybe for themselves, correctly interpreting behaviors, and how to deal with negative behaviors. The staff in this program actually put together a handbook, which is how I ended up finding Ron and this work that he's been doing here, and was really excited that it's actually in Washington, which is where I'm based. And this handbook is called The Heart of Learning and Teaching, Compassion, Resilience, and Academic Success. And it's just one of the many resources that they have for any schools that are wanting to adopt a compassionate approach to learning and teaching. I want to say that, you know, how I ended up again in this space was because I was doing a little bit of research on the effects of trauma, adversity, and how that can actually be expressed through learning, and found through the ACEs study reports and through the CDC, there was actually a link back to Washington State. And so I did a bunch of digging like I normally do online, and then lo and behold, Ron popped up on my screen. So Ron, I'm really excited to have you here with me, so welcome.
Thank you very much, Ami, and I'm very happy to be a part of this.
Awesome. Now, I know you and I had a pre-conversation on the phone a couple of weeks ago, and we both admitted that we can talk about this topic for hours and hours, because not only is it the importance of the learning and the understanding what we can do with schools, but then there's this other aspect to it, which is linked to legislation and political activities so that these programs and resources can be funded and expanded. But today, as you and I chatted about, I want to focus on the effects of it, and so that we're educating parents and non-parents out there, because I don't want the focus to be on what's not happening in terms of political activities and legislation and funding and stuff, because, I mean, that's a soapbox, again, that we could spend hours, you know, railing on. So for today's, this is about sharing with parents and adults who may have struggled in school and may actually still struggle with a condition that may be learning related, such as focus, attention, and to hear what research is telling us about the impacts of trauma and adversities and what they're recognizing and how that affects them in their learning abilities. But first, Ron, I wanted you to be able to talk about yourself and how you ended up arriving in this field.
Thank you very much for that. I grew up in Minnesota, and grew up on a dairy farm. And in the first 7 years of my education, there were eight of us in a whole school. So I'm kind of a part of, I guess you might say, a nostalgic part of America. But then when I became as junior high school or in seventh grade, I ended up going into what we called our town school at the time. And I went from two in my grade up to 133 in my grade. And that was really a struggle for me, because I wasn't used to dealing with that many peers at one time. And so I sort of shrunk back. I struggled. Both academically. I struggled in terms of fitting in. And I had a teacher in the school who I think figured that out. And he took me aside and gave me opportunities and encouraged me to become part of extracurricular activities. And so I went from feeling like an outsider to having a sense of belonging in the school, and I suddenly had a controllable group of peers that I could interact with. And that sense of belonging, that sense of safety, that sense of individuality, that I had something to contribute, really helped me in terms of feeling safe in that environment. And so that safety was really key in terms of my academic achievement. And I went from like a 2.5 up to a 3.8 GPA just by that sense of belonging alone.
So now today, let's talk about what's your educational background? You know, what did you end up pursuing after that?
Well, I was started off as a teacher. And I taught actually, I was teaching at college as a graduate assistant. And then I also was working a little bit over half time at a psychiatric hospital where I taught adolescents, we had 17 adolescents in the unit, and tried to help them keep up with their academic and school lessons while they're receiving treatment for a pretty severe mental illness because it was a secure psychiatric facility. And so that was my baptism, if you will, into teaching. But I found the whole aspect of understanding emotional makeups, understanding hardships, understanding mental illness, and the impact that has on people's lives and how we live with that or we don't live with that, became really important to me. So I moved after a few years of that into the world of social work. And I was a social worker for a number of years at the Boulder County Department of Social Services in Boulder, Colorado, and did that for about a decade before I moved here to Washington. I carried that with me here. So again, social work, became a supervisor for child welfare services here in Washington, which was my first job. And then after a few years of that, and I ended up at the headquarters for the Division of Children and Family Services at the time, I was called by the Department of Education saying, you know, we've got some issues in terms of how we're dealing with our more marginalized kids. We need better understanding for how we do that. Would you be interested in pursuing a career back in your home field of education? So I started off in education, went into social work for a while, and then came back to education with the opportunity to put the two of those together. And so it allows me to have, I think, a pretty holistic view of human functioning, learning, how it is we learn rather than, you know, what we're trying to teach kids. And that's an important concept.
That's awesome. And I like how, you know, life meanders, you know, you kind of like ebb and flow and you're like, I don't think I'm going to be a teacher anymore. And then you come back and you're like, wow, I'm back in education. How funny is this?
Yeah. Follow the path. You know, don't be resistant to it.
Right, right. Yeah, you just kind of go with the flow. So let's talk about this overarching, the definitions of trauma and stress. And, you know, I hate to sound like I harp on it, but I do always go back to the word trauma. And you and I had even talked about this in the phone conversation, how it's such an abrupt and harsh word, and it has a lot of really powerful emotional connotations to it as a word. And maybe it's not the right word, but we kind of lack a better word to describe, you know, what we're talking about here. So help define how you and the other authors and the researchers of the Heart of Learning and Teaching categorized and described trauma and stress in children and in their lives.
Sure. Thanks, Ami. For us, as you've stated here, it was a difficult word to hear. And it didn't seem to make sense to me when I first heard it, because I've always viewed trauma as very large, catastrophic, harmful events like fires, earthquakes, tornadoes, and those sorts of things that really bring catastrophic harm to our life. But what we learned through a lot of research is that trauma can be very insidious. Trauma can be something that just sort of lurks in our background and how it affects us emotionally. Trauma is not the event itself. Trauma is our response to what it is that's happened to us in our life, whether it's internal or external. And so we began to sort of reframe that word, and we had a lot of help from the state of Massachusetts. Harvard University has an arm called the Massachusetts Advocates for Children, and a woman there by the name of Dr. Susan Cole had begun some work back in, I think, about 2005, and they had written a document called Helping Traumatized Children Learn. And that was really where I first heard the term. And I think if you take the time to redefine it, it can make sense to us, but I still think it falls hard on the ear. And when you begin to hear things in that regard, we begin to have mindsets about, you know, what does that mean or whatnot. And having that sort of mindset can sometimes be harmful in our actual movement forward. And so I think we began to look at that. Now, I have to say that Dr. Sean Ginwright, he's out of Oakland, California, recently penned an article where he talked about trauma, and he talked about the impact of the word trauma. And he sort of reframed it into what he likes to call healing-centered engagement, because a lot of the kids that he was working with, as we began to use the word trauma-informed all the time in the work that we're doing, which helps put a frame around it, it also had this sort of unintended consequence of having kids see that they are identified by the worst thing that ever happened to them in their life. And that carrying that sort of identity and using those that terminology can actually hamper some of the progress that you want to make in terms of our healing. And so we're, I think, still moving around in that particular terminology and trying to find the right word. And I think you're right. We don't have necessarily a better way. And sometimes you come up with a term and it sticks and it becomes a term for a while until you realize there's a better term, which I think in some ways we're still looking for. But I think to frame it for today's conversation, and I will be using the word trauma from time to time as we talk, is we really have to understand that what's going on inside of ourselves that leads us to respond to life that happens to us in various ways can be very traumatizing. Those things that we see for a split moment can be things that we remember for the rest of our lives. I remember as a young child having seen a young boy killed in a tractor accident. You know, it was a split second of my life, but it is indelibly imprinted on my memory. And so even though that didn't happen to me, the sight of that in a vicarious traumatic sort of way can really have an impact. And so when we live in the midst of struggles in our life, poverty certainly can be a contributor to trauma in life. Not always, but it can be. Those things that happen to us if we live in abusive situations, whether it's emotional or physical abuse, those then become traumatic. And the adults may not even necessarily realize that they're being harmful to their children. They try to be helpful in some ways, but sometimes the way we say things is received by the person that we're talking to in a different way than we're intending it. And sometimes that can be traumatic. And so we're going to lump a lot of what we're talking about today under that one umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, one of the topics that I cover, you know, through the show as well is, you know, a lot of people don't identify with having seen or witnessed, you know, something that was scary or traumatic as a child. And what, you know, what researchers and therapists are also saying too is that, you know, an inappropriate response back to a kid or a lack thereof, you know, emotional neglect is another, you know, kind of traumatizing experience. If a child is, you know, trying to get attention, you know, for that's a, you know, lack of a better term, but if a child is looking to receive cues from their environment and they don't fit or they are confusing, that becomes a, you know, stressful situation for kids as well. And so, you know, I know we have got a big bucket in here, and it, you know, it goes from the kids that grow up in households where there is blatant and overt abuse and neglect all the way down to you know, just maybe it's as common as a divorce or having to move, and you know, the kid is trying to understand what's happening to them, and the adults, like you said, are unaware that their responses or lack thereof are actually generating stress in the kid, and the kid is trying to cope and deal with it, and it, you know, and it's coming out and expressing in their behaviors and stuff. How widespread do you think that, you know, how many kids do you think are actually affected by trauma and stress in the schools that you guys have seen in your research?
Wow, that's a great question. And I wanted to also just point to the fact, as we're talking about the word trauma, you notice the title of our book is really The Heart of Learning and Teaching, Compassion, Resiliency, and Academic Success. And when we named this, we decided to land on the word compassion rather than something we were working toward rather than working away from trauma. So that's a reason why we named it that way. I just wanted to get back to that. As far as it being widespread, we've had the privilege here in Washington State to have worked a lot with Dr. Rob Anda and Dr. Vincent Folletti, both of those men were the co-principal investigators on the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that was done from 1995 to 1998, where they looked at those conditions that happen in our childhood that affect our epidemiological well-being as we become into adulthood. And they found that a number of experiences that you have in your life, and it's lumped into abuse and neglect. And by the way, just a little birdwalk to the side here, there are different kinds of traumatic things that happen in boys' life versus girls' life that have a larger impact. Neglect can have a larger impact on boys, and sexual abuse has a larger impact on girls if you group that by gender. But those are some of the adverse childhood experiences that they talked about in their study. There are 10 of them altogether, and you certainly can look that up if you were to go to acestudy.org. You can learn a lot more about what those are, but they really are about household dysfunction, dealing with a mentally ill person in the home, dealing with drug and alcohol abuse in the home, incarceration, certainly domestic violence plays a big role into that, not even having been abused yourself, but just witnessing the domestic violence. In that particular study was against the mother, although, you know, domestic violence has a broader sweep than that. We took that study and correlated that with something we do here in Washington State called the Healthy Youth Survey. And it's a gathering of data. Students answer questionnaires themselves about stuff that happens in their life. And we took the adverse childhood experiences, the 10 of those, and Dr. Anda worked with our Family Policy Council at the time. And we did 10th and 12th graders. We looked at them very extensively, correlated those questions. And we came up with about 43% of our students in our classroom had an impact of 3 out of the 10 adverse childhood experiences in their life.
Wow.
And that was much higher than we thought it would ever be. So we're looking at, you know, that 43%, which today actually in some follow-up studies have actually shown to be a little higher and closer to 50% in some cases. We also did some research at the Washington State University with some of the work that was done there on ACEs and a program that we had called Readiness to Learn here at the time, to learn that there was sort of a magic number of somewhere between 3 and 4 adverse childhood experiences where it begins to impact a child cognitively. Their ability to learn is impacted by the traumas that they feel in their life. So when we took that information with that which we had from the Healthy Youth Survey, we actually found that that 43% who experienced those 3 or 4 adverse childhood experiences in their life were cognitively impaired. Now, it's not up to schools to do everything to meet the needs of students in their classrooms. But if that need happens to impact the ability for them to learn, then the schools have got to figure out a way to step up to that issue. And so that in itself is really kind of the crux of this work, why we began this work, what we learned from Massachusetts and their trauma-sensitive schools, based on their book, Trauma and Trauma-Informed Education, Our Helping Traumatized Children Learn. Those are all things that sort of began together. So in 2007, when we first heard about the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, at the same time heard about the work in Massachusetts, we thought, we've got to do something for the student population. Simultaneously, we did some research here in the state of Washington where we asked principals in the state about what their most pressing need was. And they focused on mental health, but sometimes trauma impact can look a lot like what we would see with people who are struggling with mental health issues. They said the number one thing that they were dealing with was unmet mental health needs or well-being needs of their students in school. And they didn't know how to do that, nor were they resourced to do that. So then it becomes incumbent for us to find our community partners who can help us do that work, and that includes our families.
Yeah. I know that, you know, we are dealing with this, you know, in my own household with, I've got 2 teenage kids. And, you know, they both are, you know, it's the typical, like, they could be doing so much better. You know, I'm putting air quotes around that. I know they're capable of more, you know, kind of a thing. But they're not meeting the standard, you know, that's applied, which is a grade, you know, turning in homework and sticking, you know, and meeting the levels in terms of how we evaluate their performance and their success or whatever it may be. But both of them, you know, are kind of dealing and handling life around them in different ways. It's manifesting in different ways. My one child has good, solid social relationships. My other one has difficulties maintaining them. And, you know, I had to intervene in this because just waiting for the schools to figure it out wasn't getting us any closer to helping them. You know what I mean? And it's not a fault, as you know, this isn't a fault of a school. It's not a fault of a teacher for not doing anything. I mean, it, you know, when I had the conversations with instructors and with counselors, and said, listen, I'm recognizing, you know, that the current system we have here is not going to work for these guys. What can we do differently? They were engaged to help make changes and stuff, but it does take a partnership there. And I get how easy it is as a parent to just, you know, keep trying to cram the square peg in the round hole because I've got other things to do. Like I have bills to pay and a job to go to and stuff like that. So, you know, I've definitely, you know, been going through this process myself of going, gosh, I can see how so many parents just want to keep pushing it onto the school to figure out why their kid isn't quote unquote learning and why their kid isn't doing better in school because we all view it as this academic problem. So what are the symptoms that we see with kids in the classrooms that may start to tell us that there's this underlying trauma, stress, adversity, you know, home life situation that may be impacting how they're performing in school?
Well, sometimes it can be very overt and sometimes it can be very subtle. And so we do a lot in our work right now to train teachers to be great observers, to be attuned to where their kids in their classroom might be. It can be as blatant as kids acting out and throwing a chair across the room. Or it can be as subtle as somebody who falls asleep in class, who's just checking out. And it really comes down to the word disengagement and how kids are disengaging from school. Because learning is really all about freeing up your mind in order to absorb the facts that are being presented to you. And if you're preoccupied with survival in your life, that will always trump our ability to learn. And so it's keeping a keen eye on what that might look like. It can be a sense of humor sometimes where kids are distracting and trying to keep us distracted to look over here or look over there. So I think there are any number of ways that would be, you know, too complicated to try to get in, but it can be very subtle. I think if we come down to the fact of are kids engaged with their classmates, or are they sort of a world unto themselves, a culture of one, if you will? That sometimes can be a symptom that teachers just want to check that out. And then it becomes very incumbent upon teachers to be very intentional about, you know, checking that out, asking some questions, to observe, and to not make assumptions about kids and to really take a moment. And I literally mean a moment. It doesn't take a lot of interaction with a kid to understand what's going on with them if you are skilled and have some understanding about how to ask the right questions.
Right, right. Now, you've used the frame and the term social-emotional learning. Can you talk about that, please?
That is my life. Yeah, it's right now we are developing policy in the Washington state for social-emotional learning, and it's a statewide effort. We have about 25 people in a multidisciplinary work group who are coming together to pull something together by June 30th of 2019. Social-emotional learning nationally is becoming sort of the subject du jour, if you will, or it's a hot topic right now. And it's hot because it's necessary. And I think social-emotional learning really sets the foundation and the framework for how schools can pay attention to kids who need extra help, kids who come out of trauma, where internal, externally, whatever that might manifest itself, it helps to set a foundation in a school. We have something in our schools called the multi-tiered systems of support, where you can rest fairly comfortably assured that 80% of your kids are going to be functioning in a regular classroom environment, do well, be able to manage themselves, be able to work through their challenges in life. But there's going to be 15% that are going to need some help with that. And this is according to a public health model that it's based on. 5% of those kids in your school are going to need extreme help. And if we're not prepared as schools to deal with that 5%, that 5% of kids who need extreme help is going to wear down some of that 80% of kids who function in a normal environment. So it really behooves us to pay attention to that 5% that need that additional support. The social emotional learning is really for the 80%. And the 80% that we have in our schools right now who can just go through their normal day need an environment that is, they can rest assured that their social well-being is really regarded, that they are safe in their environment, that we expect great things from them, that we have high expectations for those kids. We teach them about relationships with each other, what it's like to be accountable in relationships, how we interact, how we build in teams. We're finding today that when we go out into the work world and we talk to potential employers of the kids that are graduating from schools, and we ask them, what is it you would like to see from your students that we are graduating? They don't say, well, I really want them to come with great math skills or great skills in the subject matter that they'll be working in. We want them to learn to be analytical. We want them to learn to be able to problem solve, and we want them to be critical thinkers in life. Those are the concepts that are really honed in on with social emotional learning. And that if we teach kids, help them to become that profitable, engaged sort of person within the school system, that they feel a part, that sense of belonging that I spoke about for myself earlier in this conversation, we've given them the best leg up. Because if we can train workers who can be a part of a team, who can critically think their way through an issue or become problem solvers, those are the things that are most valuable to the future employers. So that's where social emotional learning, which, you know, some teachers do it better than others, just naturally. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they need specific instruction to call out intentional things. Like I mentioned earlier, that sometimes we're not aware. Sarcasm is rarely a good thing in a relationship. Can be funny sometimes, but in a relationship, sarcasm can be very destructive. And some people use sarcasm as a sense of humor. And when we do that with kids and we don't think about it, we can be doing a lot of harm. So just having our teachers really be aware of that. And one of the things that we're focusing on right now is not only the social emotional well-being of our kids and helping our teachers to teach that, but it's the social emotional well-being of the teachers themselves who are doing that work.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was going to be one of my questions there, because we did talk about, you know, that before that, the instructors, you know, I mean, just like anything Absolutely. In life, an awareness in these. So please continue with that right there.
Well, so we have a module on our website, and you can go to our website, which is k12.wa.us, and go to Social Emotional Learning Module, or SEL Module. And in that particular module, you will find in segment 3 of that, where we talk a lot about the importance of social emotional learning. Because, and I don't know who made this quote, but it wasn't me. You can't teach what you don't know, and you can't learn where you won't go. And so that's why it's really important for our educators to really pay attention to their own social emotional well-being. Because when we talk about ACEs, we do have a lot of teachers and a lot of school staff. And it's not just our teachers, it's our bus drivers, it's the people who serve lunch to our kids, it's the janitor who sweeps the floor, who are all interacting with kids, need to have these skills. And what we really learned is that their possession of those skills becomes absolutely paramount. So schools, we encourage their administration to create opportunities to promote well-being, self-care, that we teach people the tenets of social emotional learning for themselves. And I want to briefly go over those tenets. Our 6 here in Washington State are self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, social management, self-efficacy, which means the ability to, you know, make things happen in our lives and to break it into smaller doable goals. And then social engagement. You know, how do we interact, and are we civically responsible, and do we engage ourselves in that way? So those are the 6 competencies for social emotional learning And we're building indicators around that. We're building benchmarks about where we want to see kids have that those opportunities at certain grade bands. So we have four grade bands, which is the early elementary, late elementary, middle school, and high school, and what those developmental indicators might look like in those various competencies along their educational journey. And it doesn't follow necessarily by age. You can have kids who are in high school who may not have some of those competencies above early elementary or middle school. And so we're just constantly working in a fluid world that really defines the individuality, and that our individual learning is a very unique path. That's what social emotional learning is. It's how do you build the culture and the climate within your school that kids say, I want to be here. I am a part of this place. I want to contribute to that. And we encourage so much through this work to give students the opportunities to have voice, and not just voice, but action, that what they can do in their life matters to other people. Because I think altruism, the ability to do for other people, is one of the greatest healers for trauma ever. If we can master, if you will, our own abilities to heal ourselves and then transfer that healing so that others can be helped along the way, that just so reinforces the healing we've just done for ourselves, and so important.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. That's, I know that that's a piece of why I do what I do, is that not only am I learning and educating, but it is a way of definitely strengthening my own healing and modeling for my kids how that looks, you know, when you are going through and repairing from your life experiences that may have negatively impacted you. The piece of the self-care that I like, and I like that you guys are stretching into people besides just the teachers, because it is prevalent that we see, especially through social media, it gives us our window into the world and what goes on and where some people, you know, feel and believe. And I know my heart breaks every single time I see people posting, you know, a comment or commentary that about bad kids, you know, that and that treating a child that is acting out, a child that's a bully, and further stigmatizing and bullying that kid, and never touching, you know, the accountability of the adults around that child at all, you know. And I have seen this, I've witnessed this in schools where, you know, it may not necessarily be instructors, but I have seen, you know, staff support that, and I've heard, you know, the gossipy bad mouthing of kids, you know, because the kid, you know, calls out of school a bunch, or the kids, you know, misbehaved or whatever. There is that a mindset there. And like you had talked about, it's recognizing that we have an adult that is being triggered, you know, by the way this kid is behaving. It's triggering something in themselves and their own experiences, either as a child or, you know, what they're dealing with currently in their life, that causes them to kind of take this negative, hostile view towards children. And it, like I said, it just breaks my heart to have anything but compassion for a kid who is acting out, because that is a symptom of something that they've got happening, you know, in their life outside of that classroom and outside of that school. And that's something I try to talk to my kids about as well, you know. You know, one of the things that I saw here,
if I may say,
jump in.
I just wanted to jump in. I wanted to say that, you know, the big part of our training is just putting a new lens in front of our teachers to look at kids, to the motivation of behavior. And if we understand the science around motivation of behavior, what's causing a kid to act that way, whether it's being a bully or whether it's being passive, whatever that might be, just to take a moment to really try to understand that a little more deeply. And that new understanding, if we see a kid who's acting out in a way that is harmful to our own psyche, if you will, to understand, like, he must be really hurting inside from something that happened in his life that's not related to me. And getting teachers to depersonalize sometimes the behaviors that kids have toward them in a way that's just about their survival, not about the teacher at all. So getting that new frame is really important. I just wanted to make sure we talked about that sort of training for teachers and how they can manifest that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's great. Because, you know, we talk about how does trauma affect learning and how does it, you know, how is it coming out? One of the things that resonated with me when reading through the handbook was, and I'll read from this section here, is that when a child does not feel safe expressing a preference without first assessing the mood of a potentially volatile parent, he or she cannot fully develop a sense of self. And that this may result in an inability to define boundaries that often leads to difficulties in making independent choices, articulating their preferences, and gaining some perspective. And deficits in this area can make it hard to solve a problem from a different point of view, infer ideas from a text, or participate in group work or exhibit empathy of another, which is like a big broad range in there. And this is one of the things that why it resonated with me is because this is the area that my own son is struggling with right now, with this inattention and focus. And I, knowing his history and knowing our life, you know, beyond, you know, us living together and before he was with me, I know about that volatility and that questioning the decision-making process, you know, when he was trying to, you know, when we're trying to learn how to make choices and decisions on our own, but we're being told they're wrong or we're corrected over and over and over again. He's gotten himself to a place where he just now, he struggles to make a decision to move, you know, and so when confounded with, or, yeah, you know, confronted with a big choice, he just kind of like dissolves into it. And so, you know, what are there things?
The freeze, fright, and flight, that whole idea, I think, is what you're describing there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So his inclination is to do one thing, but he's been kind of, you know, molded into the freeze moment. So he's struggling with, you know, being able to focus in class and not paying attention, not turning in his homework, not, you know, doing all that stuff. And I'm not ready to put a label on him of that he has an attention deficit disorder or any of that stuff, but it could be something that we're dealing with. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I know a lot of adults today that actually were labeled or believed that was their issue, that they had they could have been diagnosed with having this attention and stuff. But when I read something like this, and I think this could be trauma informed, I think, well, maybe there's a different approach here. I mean, are you seeing and understanding something like that in working in this area here of getting kids to be able to comprehend school and perform, you know, in school?
Well, absolutely. And having been a person that had a very late diagnosis, actually, I was working with a psychiatrist. I'd known him for a number of years, and he basically turned to me and says, "You do know you're ADD, don't you?" And I hadn't known that, but I'd known the symptoms of it. And I'm not sure that labels necessarily help. They can sometimes help us in terms of how we might do things to help kids sort of mitigate those experiences that are in their life. But labels sometimes, if a teacher gets a hold of a label and that kid then becomes, oh, that schizophrenic kid or that ADD kid or whatever, we depersonalize those sorts of concepts. And I think that's a danger that we have to pay attention to when we're talking about making a label. If we're using a label so that we know that for a kid who struggles with ADD, we can do these things and that's helpful, then that becomes really, really important.
I agree that the label, which is why I'm hesitant to apply them, because what you guys are finding out and why we're here talking about this is that this may not be a easy medical diagnosis because there's some biological thing going on in here. This may be trauma-based. There may be something going on that actually can be resolved at, you know, outside of the kid's life that would then in turn improve, you know, this particular, you know, I'd call it a symptom that they're expressing, which is decision-making, for example, or attention or focus. Does that sound right? I mean, I guess that's where we're talking here, is that trauma is being seen as affecting the academics of kids in different ways, and this might be one of those.
Well, I think one of the things to that point, I sort of gave my, I left out one part of my work history, and that is that I worked as a children's program administrator for mental health for the state of Washington for a few years. So I went from children's division of children and family services to the mental health division. And one of the things that I noticed about mental health is that we tend to be very, a lot of the kids that we dealt with were chronic. They had deeply seated, you know, mental illnesses in their life. and that we became so clinically focused in terms of treating that mental illness that we didn't necessarily pay attention to the other real stuff that was going on in their life. And my own personal conclusion is that I think sometimes the diagnosis might be mistaken for what might be just a trauma response in somebody's life. You know, this is how I've had to become in order to deal with my internal frustrations. And this goes back to, we carry that with us into adulthood. And so a lot of our teachers who may have had some of those similar experiences about traumas in their life, it may look in many ways like a type of mental illness, when indeed it is really more trauma-based. And I would like to see more of that in the mental health world, that we're really paying attention to the trauma impact along with the mental health diagnosis that can be there. We wrote in our book, and I'm going to refer back to the Heart of Learning and Teaching again for a moment. The second chapter in our book is fully dedicated to being well, to self-care. And if we look at that self-care in terms of our own life, you know, to, in order for us to become better teachers, we underscored that title as an ethical obligation. We feel that it's an ethical obligation. If you're going to work with kids as a therapist, as a social worker, as a teacher, whatever capacity that might be, you have an ethical obligation to do your self-care and to pay attention and to develop your own self-awareness, which is one of the social emotional learning competencies. I don't know if I wandered away from the answer to your question there, but hopefully I hit it in the cracks. And if there's more clarification, please let
that's,
me know.
That's great. And I'm glad you just, that's awesome. We're good. I was shaking my head, so you can't see that on there, but I was nodding like, yes, you got in there. Okay, so Ron, let's say we're a parent listening to this episode right now, and their awareness is kind of shifting a little bit of the fact that the some behavior or lack of performance, you know, stellar performance in school might have a little bit of, you know, some home trauma, you know, again, we keep using that word, and I know a lot of parents are going to bristle, like, our house is fine. I love my kids. I'm feeding them, you know, and I don't want anybody to feel, you know, that this is finger pointing in here. But let's just say we have a parent. Their kid is not doing as well as they hoped. They, air quote, they can do better here. What kind of resources can this parent begin to explore to maybe get a different understanding, to evolve maybe a different approach with what could be helping their child, you know, that could be struggling in school?
There are a couple of resources that I really want to call out here in terms of this conversation. It really is, and I'm glad you mentioned that, I mean, about the whole idea that I don't live in a traumatized home. That's our perception. We just have to take our glasses off for a while and wear someone else's glasses for a moment, and to be able to ask those probing questions about things that we may be inadvertently unaware of that we're doing in order to set off some of these triggers in the life for these kids. That's just, when we talk about the social emotional learning and the social emotional competency of adults, the first one is self-awareness. How do we become aware of what we're feeling and how we're feeling? And that takes a level of internal, intentional concentration. So some of those tricks, I'll tell you what we do in our classrooms a lot, and especially in elementary classrooms, there is so much emphasis right now on some of the mindfulness practices that are happening in schools, getting our kids to be mindful. I have this very funny story about this woman who she called in one day to talk to the principal because she wanted to know why they were having her kid do yoga in school. And there's a curriculum out there called Yoga Calm. And it has only to do with, you know, our being present in the moment and being able to quiet our jumbled up selves sometimes when we feel that way inside. And kids really grab onto that. And so they teach them breathing, deep breath exercises, and deep breath has a big effect on the vagus nerve, and the vagus nerve effect on our blood pressure and our functioning. So we have to look at our body as a system. And the initial thing that keeps us alive, our breath, can be one of those healing things if we do it in the right way and in an intentional way to make that happen. This woman said, last night I had an argument with my husband. He was yelling at me. I started yelling back at him. And my six-year-old goes to the closet and pulls out a towel and lays on the floor and says, Mom, you need to do some yoga. And really exciting to know that things that are happening in schools are coming home to to practices that, parents can teach. Getting how do we become mindful in a noisy world? If you live in a home where there's so much chaos and noise and anger and yelling and people are yelling at each other, well, I don't know why you're so affected. I'm not yelling at you. I'm just yelling at your mother. Those sorts of things can have such a huge impact for kids who are especially sensitive. Those are the things that we have to build our own awareness around. So when we do the self-awareness piece, kids understand that I got something that I'm not feeling good about inside of me. Then we move into the self-management piece. Then we learn those little techniques about being able to just close your eyes for a moment, take some deep breaths, send your brain to a place that you know makes you happy, and be able to visualize visualization exercises. In our schools, when kids, 2 minutes of breathing can de-escalate a kid faster than any kind of medication or any other thing that we might be able to do for them. So sometimes they use a chime just to sort of help kids center and to quiet down all the other noises that are happening in their head. And this has been a hugely important part. How we treat each other, too, how we talk to each other, asking questions, being very careful. So I want to point out someone here who I think has done some amazing work. And her name, and she has a YouTube video out there. Her name is Becky Bailey, Dr. Becky Bailey. And she has a program called Conscious Discipline. And it's how we talk to our kids, how we respond to our kids. And if you go to YouTube and look up Dr. Becky Bailey and Unconscious Discipline, there is a video that is very funny to watch, but also kind of painful because it can really point out, oh my gosh, that's the way I talk to my kid. And she demonstrates how we talk to our kids and how we sometimes over-identify with them, or sometimes we dismiss them, or sometimes we meet anger with anger. And then at the end lesson, she says, here's a coaching. This is a coaching thing. If we enter into our lives of our children as a coaching and use the ability for that relationship that we have with our kids to coach and direct, and we help them redefine and reframe some of the things that are going on in their life, that's where we get to the problem solving, critical thinking, analysis part of, oh, I can do that for myself. So those sorts of things are really important. Lots of research out there. I did want to mention that as for social emotional learning, people who really want to dig into that and understand that, I would go to the Collaborative for Academic and Social Emotional Learning, otherwise known as CASEL. They have lots and lots of ideas out there. We have the Aspen Institute. We have the American Institutes for Research. Those are the three organizations who are doing most of the research now around social emotional learning. And they will have all kinds of little ideas about how schools can begin to implement programming. Remember I talked earlier about the culture and the climate of the school. Well, the culture and climate of the home is probably much more important even than the culture and climate in the school. And for us as family members to look at that culture and climate, we may have gotten used to it, but is it as healthy as it could be? And are there things that I could be doing to make it healthier? Can I talk to my spouse? Can I talk to my kid in a different way that might get a different response? And to try different things out and to do it mindfully and intentionally.
Yeah. And so for everybody that's listening, you'll know that I'll have all these links in the podcast description. So I'm going to go through and collect everything, and I'll have a link to the YouTube video, and I'll have a link to all of these website resources for everybody to follow up. So when you get out of the car after you're listening to this episode, get home, you can actually get back to the podcast description and find these. Okay, so Ron, for any of the teachers that are out there, and I know I have several listeners that actually do work in education, not only in Washington State, but around the country and around the world, quite honestly, what are the resources where they can find out about the program you're working on and maybe start to get to be able to take some of that in and see how if they can apply it to themselves in their own classrooms or in their own districts and states?
Very difficult question to answer, Amy. I think there's so many places to go. When we started this work back in 2007, we had to struggle to find research. And now I think in my email on a daily basis, I will come up with five or six different things. Have you read this? Have you seen this? Have you looked at this? And so much of it is so important. I think what I would do to really sort of center this, we're still working toward the development of, I mean, our website, I think, in the book. Within the book, if you want to train on the contents of the book, and there are four main chapters to the book, it's understanding trauma, where it comes from. I think it's important to understand some of the basic brain development. That's really important. Second chapter is about self-care. Third chapter is about classroom implementation. And the fourth chapter is how do we engage our community. Along with that, and under resources on that same page, there's a PowerPoint presentation that you can use. There's a script along with that to begin to train and introduce this subject. It's really important to know that there's a readiness to benefit factor here for schools, that you don't suddenly say, oh, I want to do this, and then the next day you begin doing it. It's a thought process. It is how are we going to do this? How are we going to scaffold this? How are we going to put this into our schools? To begin the thoughtfulness and examination about what you're currently doing that may be good. And I think strength-based is absolutely the way to go with this, whether it's on a personal level or on a systemic level, like within a school and a community, that you do and you celebrate those things that are working best first. I would go to the Department of Education in Wisconsin. They have a website that has an amazing, they've used a lot of our work in that, but they've done a beautiful job of assembling the trauma-sensitive schools body of work there and pointing you to a lot of different directions that we haven't even gotten to yet today. They also have some pretty good work on social emotional learning as well. I would say the Aspen Institute, CASEL, the Collaborative for Academic and Social Emotional Learning, and the American Institutes for Research are also places that will have a lot of tips and tricks. Sometimes just Googling it will bring up things that are particular of interest to you and to that may fit with your family. So that's kind of where I would start. We do have a resource guide in the back of our book in Chapter 6. That was created in 2008, and since then the level of information has exploded. So I don't think you have to go far to really find some good solid research on that, but that's where I would start.
Right. Great. Well, and you know, I'd like to add to that, because what you are describing is just exactly how exciting this field really is, and also why it can feel and seem like this is, you know, a lot of people are like, I didn't know this even was going on. And that's exactly right. The research is emerging right now. You know, I mean, as you're describing, 10 years ago, it wasn't there. The ACEs study, again, was done 20 years ago. And now we're beginning to see those impacts in there. And so that's, to me, that's why I think this is an important episode, is to, you know, we might be able to get past a lot of the things that we were seeing our kids struggle with, or what we may have struggled with even, you know, in our childhood with learning, and seeing that there are new ways of looking at it and ways that can actually be affected positively, you know, just not to get the kid to perform better in school. But I mean, if you're able to address trauma and stress and eliminate it, neutralize it, you know, which is really the best, you know, as an adult we can do. And the long-term effect isn't just that the kid's going to do better in school. The kid is just going to grow up into a healthier, happier adult. And to me, that's an exciting piece of knowing all of this now and being able to step in and do something with it. So I'm happy there are people, like so happy there are people like you, Ron, you know, that are out there working on all of this stuff. And I'm grateful for you taking the time. We just scratched the surface. You know that. I know that. But I'm hoping that we were able to share some information with people and have them, again, maybe look at their own kids or look at their own life experiences a little bit differently by understanding this emerging science in neurodevelopment and therapies and adverse situations. So thank you so much for being here with me today.
Well, Ami, thank you very much. I so appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. It's still in the beginning stages. We have a lot of work to do, but we better get to it. And I was really glad that you had said something about our goal was creating happy, healthy adults for our kids. And we keep that as our goal that we're working toward. I think we'll have it.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiricone.com. And there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.